This is Robert Scheer with another edition of Scheer Intelligence. And today we're going to encounter intelligence in the form of Denis Kucinich and really a very rich history of an encounter with American power. And just as a personal footnote, I'm doing this interview now because he's written a really marvelous book called The Division of Light and Power. And it actually comes out in a couple of days. We're recording it earlier, but when we go on the air on Friday, 3 days on June 8th, it's going to be available. It's already, you can pre-order it, the Kindle version on Amazon and elsewhere, independent bookstores, I hasten to add. And I want to say that this is really, you know, Denis did a very good interview with Matt Taibbi. I don't like being scooped, but this time it was good because I thought I know Denis very well. I know his whole history and I've known him for 40 years. We'll discuss that a bit. But Matt Taibbi caught something really essential about Denis's journey. He had covered him when Denis was running for president. He had followed his careers. And he said, you know, the media elite, they kind of referred to him as sort of a left-wing nut. And who is this guy and what's he all about? And actually, in that interview, Matt Taibbi ties you to a really rich history of American populism. And I think that's a very interesting point on which to start. And he asks you a question. He says, isn't the Denis Kucinich story really a story about not selling out? And I know you haven't even read this interview yet. I asked you. But it's interesting that he focused on that. And not selling out was a critical part of a populist tradition in America that took on power, sometimes on the right and sometimes on the left. And in Cleveland, where you ran for the city council and won in 1969 and surprised everybody by, you know, beating a machine, Democratic Party machine candidate. And then you went on to be mayor of Cleveland from 78, 79, when I first interviewed you for the LA Times and then later Playboy magazine. And you were in that populist tradition. And why, give us the name of the mayor, I'm blocking on it now, who was this great populist. I believe there's a statue to him in Cleveland. And talk about your own political origin. Where does Denis Kucinich come from?
Well, first of all, the mayor that you speak of, Bob, was Mayor Tom Johnson. And he was a mayor of whom Lincoln Steffens wrote in his collection called Shame of the Cities. He called Tom Johnson the best mayor of the best governed city in the United States. And Tom Johnson really looked to see how he could get the benefits of municipal operation to the people of the city. He stood for public transit, for municipal electricity. He said in his book, which was published in 1911, that I believe in municipal ownership of all public service facilities, because if you do not own them, they will in time own you. They'll corrupt your politics, rule your institutions, and finally destroy your liberties. And it was Tom Johnson 110 years ago, and his legacy included the Cleveland Municipal Electric System, which I took up that fight in 1969, and it culminated in a tremendous battle in 1978 and 79.
And the battle is discussed in The Division of Light and Power, and it's a classic story about the struggle for the public interest. And that's where the Denis Kucinich journey publicly begins. But first, you know, about yourself. You were only 23 years old at that time. 23, right. And you took on an entrenched Democratic Party machine politician. Everybody forgets our big cities most often, and particularly in the North, well, no, in the South, of course, as well, were ruled by Democratic politicians, you know, Carmen DiSapio and the Tammany Hall in New York and the Chicago machine and so forth. And what prompted you At the age of 23, and this is at the end of the 60s, but you're influenced a bit by the 60s. You're also influenced by the Catholic Church, which provided your education. You're also influenced very much, and this book records it, by a life of poverty, really, working class poverty. So take us to who was this 23-year-old kid, which your book describes. It's a marvelous book and giving us an insight into an America of economic losers, which, of course, your father, with his seven children, following a Catholic model of family, was destined to be almost.
Well, first of all, you know, I won on my second time around. So I entered the political fray as a 20-year-old candidate, and I ran for city council in the same ward in which I attended high school. And I came within 500 votes of beating this entrenched Democrat, and then I campaigned for 2 years, and I was elected. You know, what brought me into politics was a feeling that the people I grew up with didn't have a voice in government, that their concerns were always marginalized, that you know, their economic concerns about the cost of utilities, about cost of public transit, about public services for which, you know, they may pay a certain amount of taxes, that their concerns were always pushed to the margin, and that those who ruled the city weren't even the public officials. They were institutions or individuals who were in the private sector, and they just made the decisions. So when I was growing up in the city of Cleveland, all that, I will tell you that when you're living in a socially disorganized background, the last thing on your mind is politics. Voting is, you know, kind of an abstraction. You're really worried about trying to survive day to day. When, you know, we had seven children in the family, as you mentioned, had trouble finding rent, never owned the house. We moved around a lot. And as we moved from place to place, it was always like, well, we have a roof over our head. Where's the next meal coming from? Can we pay the bills? How do we avoid getting evicted? Sometimes we were evicted. Sometimes we lived in a car. Today there's a lot more people in America who have that background. But I will tell you that for us, it was I had searing memories of the difficulties that my parents went through. And I told myself as a young person, if I ever got anywhere in life, I'd try to do something to help those people who, like my own family, were pushed to the margins, left out, ignored, derided. And so when I got to city council, I knew who my constituents were. And when I became mayor, I knew unambiguously who I was there to represent.
Well, but let's be clear about that. You didn't come from any kind of leftist ideological background.
You're not
swept up in any countercultural movement of hippies or what have
you. No, Bob, I'm not ideological.
No, but you weren't even a
I wasn't
that. You weren't a cultural, but you were square as could be.
Yeah, I guess you could say that.
Good Catholic education. Uh-huh. You tried to be, you were this short, skinny guy, and you were the third string quarterback on your high school team, and they locked you in a locker once in a while to taunt you. I know a lot about your background because, as I say, I interviewed you when you were mayor. We can get into that a little bit. And in fact, this book we're here to discuss, The Division of Light and Power, the life story, really, of Dennis Kucinich. And I agree with Matt Taibbi and Chris Hedges and other people and Ralph Nader, who has read it and praised it. This is really a story of American hopefulness, that out of the American experience, you know, here in the case of a Catholic urban kid from a poor working class background, comes to shine a light on and you have a very interesting beginning in this book of, you know, go fight City Hall, but first you have to find out where is City Hall? Where is the power? Where, this is really a book about power in America and unraveling it. And so take us there. You know, again, when you're 20 years old, starting to run, what caused a kid from, Catholic education? Was it your teachings? What was it that caused you to care about politics and get involved?
Yeah, the question about the relationship between ethics that I, you know, learned in catechism and action You know, it probably reflects on some of the, what, you know, later became well known as the Catholic worker movement. And the idea that our lives don't belong just to ourselves.
Oh, you're wrong, by the way. The Catholic worker movement preceded you. Dorothy Day and all those people. I'm sorry to lecture you, Dennis, but
no. I agree. Okay, it preceded me. But what I'm saying though is that the sentiments were part of what I grew up with, and you know they preceded my being in elected office certainly. But the sentiments are things that I grew up with, and the teachings that I received had to do with always, you know, try to do the right thing even when no one's looking. Especially when no one's looking, and to always try to be of service to people, you know, is really almost.
Well, when no one's looking, let me stop you because I do teach ethics at USC, and I've consulted once in a while on this with you. Actually, I know a little bit about it, but the not looking, someone's looking. It's an almighty, right?
If you believe in something like the soul, yes, there is that sense of the omnipresence of a spiritual force that's inside us and also outside us, and that's part of the religious teaching that I received, and I took it to heart, not in a didactic way, not in a way that is rigidly catechetical, but in a way that you try to be fair with people, you try to do what's right because you know that's where you should live, and so you know as I was growing up with that, I also saw the experience that my parents had, how they were being cheated in the marketplace, you know, with you know buying televisions that didn't work, buying cars that would break when they took them off the lot. You know, getting food at a market that maybe wasn't fresh, and you know, on and on and on, the kind of insults that people experience every day in the inner city, the kind of stuff that David Kaplowitz wrote about a half century ago called "The Poor Pay More," and you know, when I saw what my parents went through, I saw the difficulties they had, and I saw how that was shared by many of the people in the neighborhoods in which we lived. You know, you have to remember that there were times where we were living in communities where we were the only Caucasian family in a community of color. And so my neighbors were experiencing the same economic conditions. They just happened to be Black. And if anyone wants to know about my politics, remember where I grew up, because I have the same sensibilities that come from living in that inner city environment that causes one to ask questions about why are people so poor? Why are people denied a decent education? Why are people not having a good health care? You know, there's so many questions that you're asked, but at the same time, finding the answers is another thing because you just kind of throw it off. Well, that's the system, and no one really knows what the system is until you get inside of it, and then you start to peel back the layers, you know, like peeling an onion, and you finally find the truth of it, which is that the system is run by institutions and elements that are usually beyond the control of the democratic process.
Now, I want to get to that because that's really what the book is about. And I think Matt Taibbi did put his finger on it. Quite a few of us have come up. I grew up in the Bronx and my parents were garment workers and so forth. And there was always somebody saying, yeah, but you don't have to live like this. You know, you can sell out. They don't use those words. But also, you know, that's the whole thing of the sort of meritocracy. Do it a certain way and you can get ahead and get out of that and so forth. And then basically end up forgetting about the people who didn't, who got stuck, and which is nowadays the majority of people get stuck. And people of color always got stuck. And so I want to deal with that because you're running and you're an independent and you do that shocks the whole machine. And you're 23 years old and you're there in the city council. You've won. And the book really describes what selling out is all about in America. And we're talking, 40 years ago, all right? And I came and interviewed you at that time after when you were mayor. But there you are in city council. And the book is, it's the worth the price of the book for anything, for a lot of it. But that description, here's a 23-year-old kid. He fits into the Cleveland community. People identify with him. He's now at city council. And basically these old timers in the Democratic machine are kind of saying, okay, kid, what are you about? You know, and what do you need? We'll buy you off. And all the forces that buy off politicians emerge, ranging from the banks to the mafia. So take us through that story. Where was 23-year-old Dennis Kucinich, and what were the pressures on you at that time?
The minute I got into city council, it was very clear that, okay, you're here now, you're one of us, forget why you ran, forget whatever you said in the election. There's great opportunities for anyone here who plays ball. And, you know, the message was, join the club, go along to get along, and it's going to be good for you personally, financially, and for your career.
So put us with the people, though. These are party hacks, really.
Well, you know, they're individuals.
Kid, what are you all about?
Right. And I suppose it was a surprise to them to see someone elected who could have been their grandson. And
you being an entrenched politician.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, actually, what I learned about politics was from people who told me as I went door to door what he did for them, what the machine did for them, because that was my charge then to show that I could do that and be their voice at the same time. But yeah, I beat a machine that had been unassailable. So I, you know, my initiation was to a system that basically was operating for its own self-aggrandizement. And when I saw that, I thought, wait a minute, that's not why I'm here. That's not what I'm about. My direction is totally different. And I think that probably caused a certain level of a source for the people with whom I was working, my new colleagues. And sooner than later, I found that I was at odds with other members of council on what turned out to be the pivotal issue in my life, and that is the municipal electric system. Members of council had committed to selling it to this utility monopoly, and they wouldn't agree to finance the repairs that the city system needed to be competitive. They actually crippled the city system because of the influence of the utility lobbyists on behalf of the Cleveland Electric Illuminating Company. So when I saw,
just to put the record straight, people don't necessarily know that we've had a lot of public assets that the public owned and that served the public and served capitalism actually quite well. I'm looking at one here in Los Angeles, and where I'm sitting, the Department of Water and Power, and which is publicly owned in Los Angeles. And when we've had our crises with the big utilities companies, they've actually performed in a much better way. So in Cleveland, you had a case study. You had a municipal electric system that basically was being cut out of contact with the national grid because there was this whole move towards privatization and everything, which is
right
now out of control.
Right.
Take us to what that was about, what Muni represented.
Well, Cleveland was somewhat of an anomaly because while there's over 2,000 municipal electric systems, there's very few where a private utility and a public utility compete head-to-head in Cleveland's case. In a third of the city, and the existence of the municipal electric system in Cleveland was forestalled at the turn of the century. The Cleveland Electric Illuminating Company tried to block the creation of an electric system. The city wanted to annex communities that had their own electric system, and the CEI blocked that. But finally, the creation of Muni Light prevailed. About 1913, and what happened is that any way that the Cleveland Electric Illuminating Company, CEI, had in those intervening decades to block the expansion of Muni Light, they did that. And when they finally got a council they could work with, and it was about the time that I arrived on the scene, they were just about to close the deal. And so, you know, and what was happening, and this is really in a very important part of the book opens with a blackout that occurs at Christmas time. And spoiler alert, as you read the book, you find out that blackouts were being created by the private utility to try to convince the customers of Muni Light that they should switch over to this other utility. And whenever there was a blackout, the CEI would send its salespeople into the Muni Light neighborhoods that were affected with their contract saying, here, look, we'll give you a utility that works, that's reliable. And sometimes they threw in free wiring in the deal. I mean, this was there was corporate espionage, sabotage.
It's the Enron story. You preceded the Enron story.
Yeah, right.
And what they did with the brownouts in California.
Exactly. Yeah. And so when that's where I arrived on the scene and I saw this going on. I thought, wait a minute, there's something wrong here. Why is anybody standing up and speaking out against this? And so I basically volunteered to do that. I stepped forward and that changed my life. Little did I know that issue of public power would, and my involvement in it, would cause me to get in the mayor's race in 1977 and actually be elected mayor. And the story, of course, doesn't end there. That's not even halfway through the story. I got elected mayor, and then the private utility, which was furious that I had actually blocked the sale. There was a done deal. The petition drive I put forward blocked the sale. I get elected. And that's when they really came after me. I'm in my living room in Cleveland right now where I've been in this home for the better part of 50 years. And I'm looking at a wall where, it's been plastered over where a high-powered rifle shot just missed my head by a fraction during the time that I had this petition drive going to try to, or was making an effort to try to block the sale legislatively. And so, there was a lot of money on the line here. And when I got involved in this issue, as I write in the book at the beginning, questioning why we're having so many blackouts. And as I go through this journey and I find out, this is all part of a plan to try to force the city to sell this electric system. And that was part of a bigger plan. And I actually had a place at a bay window where I looked out at an incredible amount of corruption that was going on in my own city that very few people were aware of. And you wouldn't have known it unless you started to ask the questions about why they're trying to sell this electric system and why is the system being rigged to try to make sure that a simple thing like running an electric system, that the city, for some reason, can't do that.
Time for a break, and we'll be back in a few minutes. We're back with Sheer Intelligence and our guest. So this is the heart of the whole thing, you are there discovering that the people who run City Hall are not in City Hall, basically.
Right.
And you can get all agitated about the City Hall people, but unless you elect some people who want to unravel these relationships, and they're very complex. I do want to say, for people saying, yeah, maybe you saw it or not, the Cleveland Plain Dealer, which was the main newspaper, was very vicious towards you, attacked you every which way. But as I recall, what was it, 10 or 20 years after the fact, they said Dennis was right? That the power plant was not sold, and it was a good thing that it was not sold to the private interests?
Well, it wasn't just a plain dealer. There were many institutions.
No, but I remember, because I happened to be in Cleveland because my son wanted to go see the baseball team, and it was the headline in the plain dealer. Dennis was right.
Yeah, it was 1993.
Ah.
And I would say that...
wait a minute. Let me do the math here. So that's... 23 years after the fact?
25. Let's do the math. So 78 was the battle. The fight began in 69.
No, my math is wrong. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah. Yeah. I started fighting in 69. And when I began the serious effort that actually was instrumental in blocking it, that happened from 74 to 76. And I was drawing editorial fire left and right because the media, for the most part, was getting tremendous, getting significant amounts of advertising money from the utility, from the private utility. And in some cases, as we discovered in the book outlines, the utility is actually bragging about the editorial influence they had. It was so significant they would take, they'd write the news stories or write the editorials and take them into the newspaper and get things printed verbatim. I mean, this was the condition in Cleveland at the time that I kind of walked into, unawares that this previously unawares that this was how things were working at City Hall.
You had actually worked for the Plain Dealer as a sort of copy messenger? Mm-hmm,
right. It was great. Oh, what a great job it was. Oh, my
okay.
God.
Wait a minute. So now you're the mayor, and I'm making light of it, but you just mentioned before a bullet comes through. I mean, you had organized crime against you. You had the big banks that put the city into foreclosure. You had all the powerful interests in that community out to destroy this 23-year-old who had the audacity to become get on the council and then become mayor, a bit older then, and what, 3 years older? And, your life was at stake.
Well, in terms of when the pressure was really on was when I blocked the sale. I was moving between city council and a judicial office called clerk of courts. And in a two-year period, I challenged the sale. I blocked it. I announced I was running for mayor, and that was the time frame that where things became very dangerous. And you know, when I was elected mayor, I was 31, but the journey was a journey that started in 1969 and went over an 8-year period. That's what the Division of Light and Power covers. That, and like many journeys, you start on a path. And every step is a discovery, and you find out almost like a parallel would have been Ibsen's Enemy of the People, where Dr. Stockman discovers that the town's baths are polluted, and you think people want to know that. Well, it turns out they didn't, and that was Ibsen's point, that the compact majority will accept certain conditions only because they're benefiting economically. And so I, as I went into this journey, and I found out not that the town's baths were polluted, but that a municipal electric system was being stolen with the complicity of every institution in town, including government. All of a sudden, it's like, how could that be? Wait a minute, this can't be right. Some people would say, well, yeah, it was right. And Bob, you know, after 40 years, I finally was able to tell the story and have it documented.
Yeah, I should mention, you know, I have something, full disclosure, with your book. Because when I interviewed you when you were in mayor and you were all in the middle of this incredible storm and everything, I interviewed you for the LA Times. I really didn't know anything about you. I think I'd seen you on the Johnny Carson show or something. Were you already on one of those national shows, the youngest mayor in America, and you were kicking up this storm? I went, the LA Times sent me there to interview you, and that was okay. And I was sort of, wow, this is a really good story, and you're fighting the good fight. And as I say, the Cleveland Plain Dealer and most of the media at that time thought, you know, you're out of your mind, and why are you doing this? Who needs a public utility? And I noticed more recently, even the Washington Post had said, well, you know, Dennis was right. And actually, he was a precursor to AOC and all of these progressives, in some ways, Bernie Sanders and others, you know, the whole progressive wing of the Democratic Party. But at the time, you were kind of a lone voice because you weren't really part of the cultural revolution. You were kind of a square, young Catholic schooled kid. Trying to do the right thing by your neighbors, and the media never really got you, and they try to peg you. And you weren't partisan, really. You weren't politically with the labels. And you were just there doing what Lincoln Steffens described, or Mr. Smith goes to Washington, right? It's an incredible American story. Again, the title is The Division of Light and Power. It's actually going to be available for sale 3 days after we first broadcast this. It'll be for sale. I think I try to get it today. I had a copy. But I wanted to get a new copy, and June 8th is when it goes on sale. But it's a movie. you know, who is this kid and why is he doing this? And it's really taking you, and even in your journey, we're not going to go through your whole journey through Congress and everything, but you actually have been vindicated by the emergence of a progressive wing of the Democratic Party, a new, really invigorated one, and really the pressure are even on President Biden to do something about the abysmal condition of the working class in America now, with unions all destroyed and concentration of power in the hands of, you know, these huge oligopolies and monopolies. So, but back then, when I went to interview you, and I wrote this for the LA Times, even people back at our paper said, well, no, he's just a wild kid. He doesn't know what he's doing. But you had really figured out the math. You'd figure it out, the swindle. You know, you have in your book, you say the game is rigged, but you got to figure out how it's rigged and who's doing the rigging.
Right.
And that's what you managed to do. And everybody said, you're nuts. Not everybody, because there were union people who supported you. There were progressive people. There were civil rights people who supported you. And you built, were able to build a popular coalition. And by the way, you spent 16 years in Congress, and your congressional career was destroyed not by Trumpian right-wing Republicans. It was by your fellow Democrats who gerrymandered your district.
That's correct.
You know, and they basically did you in.
They chopped up the 10th Congressional District, which didn't belong to me. It belonged to people, you know, throughout the Cleveland area who had a representative in Congress. Now they may have one technically, but, you know, the seat was moved to Toledo, Ohio. And that was done with the help of the state Democratic Party. I seldom have a chance to talk about that. But when I was in Congress, you know, I'm a Democrat, but I'm not someone who hews to a party line. As a matter of fact, that kind of groupthink, to me, always did violence to cognition, that you really have to be able to call things as they are and to see them in clear light without the prism or the lens of a partisan position. And the more, you know, when I saw how partisanship produced a kind of polarization and people would choose up sides without even thinking about where they actually stand and why they stand where they stand, I just said, you know, nah, I'm not into that. This is, I come from the neighborhoods of the city. What you see is what you get. If something's right, it's right, no matter if a Republican or a Democrat is for it. If something's wrong, it's wrong without regard to a partisan label. And so that's the way I conducted myself in Congress as well. And while, you know, my feeling is that that the ability to be able to see clearly, you cannot have that if you are looking at everything through ideology or through partisanship. I just kind of like to look at things as they are and call them as I see them. And, you know, in the words of Emerson in his essay on self-reliance, it's about trusting oneself and believing that's what's true for you could be true for others. And it's not in any egocentric or braggadocious way. It is simply to say, well, yeah, this is actually what's happening. If you see a robbery in progress, you don't call it a charitable contribution. And what happened in Cleveland, it was a robbery in progress. The corporations were trying to steal the city's municipal electric system, and I blew the whistle on them, and I stopped them.
Well, you know, that's an important consideration. You know, I'm living here in Los Angeles, where we have a huge homeless population, where we have a lot of people struggling in the Latino community and elsewhere for good jobs. We have a lot of issues. And, you know, we've had progressive democratic leadership, so-called. We're in a deep blue state. And these problems have not been attended to in a serious way. And this partisan issue is really a cop-out in a way, because as long as you've got the, you know, it's like the Cold War. You got the communists, you got the, right, the Soviets, and everything else you do must be virtuous, you know. So there's like Trump washing. But the reality is, you know, that these problems have festered. And in the case of Cleveland, you know, the destruction of the labor movement, the destruction of the rights of working class people and so forth, that went on with the support of both Democrats and Republicans. In the main, the embrace of a world economy in which basically workers get screwed. They're not part of the trade. So let's talk a little bit about that, because the book really is it's interesting. You preceded this current time. And the time now is, you know, maybe it's a good way to kind of, I want people to read the book. It's worth getting the book just to see this populist struggle in Cleveland and where Dennis Kucinich comes from. But the messages are long-lasting, because basically at the heart of populism is concern for the ordinary person. You know, and making the system work for them. I don't care whether you're talking about the Athenian democracy or the Roman Empire or any other Scandinavian democracy. The final measure is, you know, how well attended are the common people, the average person, and we lose that. And
well, that's true.
You were the rare person who challenged that. Now, for example, coming from the Bronx, I'm happy that AOC represents my old area in the Bronx, and I think she is a progressive. But I watched the Bronx go down the tubes as a journalist. I wrote about it under Democratic leadership, even over the New York Times. You hardly had any reporting about a whole borough sinking into absolute economic misery. You know, where when I would go there, I couldn't even find a place to stay in a hotel. You know, the whole borough went through a nightmare. And you had Democratic leadership of a city. You had an enlightened media. And so what you did in saving that one public institution was not done in lots of other places. And the reason that California became subject to Enron's mercies and so forth with the brownouts that destroyed the state and so much of life there for a while, was because people looked the other way, and it was Democrats and Republicans that allowed Enron to be Enron, you know. And I want to get to a big theme in your book, but in closing, that Matt Sahibi, I want to give him credit, really got to the heart of your book in this interview, in his interview with you. And that is really about, what is the role of the public sector? And can you have democracy if you turn your whole economy over to privatization? And privatization is what the bipartisan politics have been about, and actually all over the world. I mean, even the countries that call themselves communists now embrace a kind of rapacious, exploitive notion of capitalism, like China or Vietnam, for that matter, Russia with its cartel capitalism. So, you know, let's talk about that. What is the public role? This is really your big contribution. You were willing to fight for a vigorous public role that the banks wanted to destroy, and you tried to hold it back.
I mentioned this before, and it bears mentioning again. As Mayor Johnson said 110 years ago, that these public service monopolies, like a light system, water systems, public parks, schools, they're part of the wealth of a community. And he said that if you don't own them, they will in time own you. Now, what's happening and why this book becomes so important today is that in the post-COVID era, when cities are going to be struggling to get back on their feet, absent an infusion of federal cash, you will see in city after city decisions being made about the selling off of public assets. As a matter of fact, Bob, I point out, before I became mayor, there were about 100 utilities across America that were privatized. And people, you think of all the fights that could have occurred but maybe didn't in those communities, but Muni Light was different. We, you know, I challenged it. But today, if you look at the statistics on privatization, not just in the United States, but globally, thousands and thousands of public assets are being auctioned off, often to the lowest bidder. And, you know, whether it's telephone companies or sewers or water system or waste collection, in some case, public safety, you know, this is what we're facing. And when corporations start to take those things that have been part and parcel of an expression of democratic governance, of things that people have control over, you move from a model, the hope for a democratic model, to something that is not, that could in some ways be of moving towards a totalitarianism. And so how do we avoid, you know, an American gulag? How do we avoid finding a condition where we've lost all of our rights? Well, that's what the division of light and power is really about. It's about taking a stand. It's about calling things as they are. It's about standing up in the moment, not being afraid of the risks that you might take, you know, on yourself politically, but really just standing for the truth. And that's tough. You know, it's very tough. But at the same time, is there any other way to live? You either live standing up or you live on your knees. And to me, I stood up for the people of the city. And I, how did I know at that time, 44, 45 years ago, that today, here in 2021, the issues that I took a stand on would be as relevant as they are, not just in this country, but literally globally, because of the rapaciousness of corporate privatizers who just look to government as being their next source of free money.
Well, you know, I'm going to end it as I often threaten to end it and go on maybe longer than we should in these shows. But, you know, the interesting thing is how much has been privatized. I mean, we've just had Business Insider had a very good story about how, you know, this whole thing of gift giving by people, the commitment by Bill Gates and Warren Buffett and Mark Zuckerberg that they'll give away money and so forth. They actually have ended up giving a very small percentage, or not very much higher than they are required by law to give through foundations and so forth. But just the very idea that we can't fight medical problems in the world without private charity. And everybody forgets when you do this private giving, you're avoiding taxes. That's really what it's all about. You instead of taxing the super wealthy, they can have these cop-outs. And the same thing is done with the deregulation. After all, this started really not just with Ronald Reagan, but really was given tremendous force by Bill Clinton. And that's how we got the whole housing meltdown and everything, which affected Cleveland very much with these phony mortgages. It did every city in America. And so I want to end this with really – you don't have a crystal ball, but we're in a moment where a Democratic president, and I have to give him credit for that, Joe Biden, has said he wants to reinvigorate the public sector. And he's asking for an awful lot of money in his new budget to do that. But you've been in Congress, you were in Congress for 16 years, and you're also on the local level. And what that fight is largely, from my memory, going to be fought by lobbyists, is it not? And how, you know, I know Ralph Nader read your book, and he was the great champion of public accountability from corporations, everything from seatbelts to how, you know, the defense spending is. And what do you think is happening now? Is there a chance? And what should the public do to make sure this money is not just thrown back at the fat cats, and then people say, oh, yeah, you can't trust government. It doesn't do anything good.
Well, as I pointed out in Division of Light and Power, that government works. The question is, who's it working for? And I'm hopeful that some of the reforms that Joe Biden's talking about will be enacted. I think we have to be aware that the elements of a more permanent government that rest in the hands of certain multinational corporate interests are going to be influential in any policies that are adopted. I remember when I came to Congress and China trade was an issue. I stood against it, but you know there were five lobbyists for every member of Congress on China trade, and they basically swarm members of Congress and spin them around and bringing people from their district. And it was a massive lobbying effort that set the stage for the accelerated destruction of America's industrial economy.
Why are you blaming it on China? My goodness.
Not blaming China.
Yeah, the thing is...
Listen, let me be specific about that. Boeing came to my office and they were promoting China trade. And I said, wait a minute, you're giving China the prototypes of aircraft that should be made in this country. No, it's like China was a platform that corporate America could go to in an effort to reduce the amount of money they were paying workers. I mean, that's all. You know, this was really an attack on American workers.
I'm glad that we stumbled onto this because I think this is the big issue that faces us going forward. The big attack on China is, oh, the government subsidizes business. Well, our government is subsidized, but that's what the whole defense industry was about. And our government has done a lot of things to subsidize profit and just saying, okay, Chinese companies should be privately owned is not going to solve the problem. The real problem is, what are the conditions that workers have? What are their free speech rights, their right to organize, their right to strike? So taking that and then tying in the I'm glad we've got this because I want to discuss this a little bit, the environmental impact, because after all, we polluted China with all this massive production. You can hardly breathe in Beijing for 5 months of the year and so forth. The real issue in these trade agreements, and it really oddly relates back to Cleveland. You know, are you going to have government operate to enhance the life of ordinary people? And that includes ordinary Chinese people, as well as people in Cleveland.
So here's the thing. In 1999, as a member of Congress, I organized 114 members of Congress in a letter to Bill Clinton that said, look, we ought to have workers' rights, human rights, and environmental quality principles in all of our trade agreement. And we used that to block a trade agreement that was being negotiated during the period of the Seattle marches, where the Turtles and Teamsters marched together in the streets of Seattle. I can tell you that it's the American politicians' unwillingness to stand for those things that opened the door for corporations to go to China, because if there was never a debate here, China becomes much easier to move to. But it was, and really, it's about exporting our democracy. In the same, you know, if I could draw a parallel between the division of light and power and this discussion that you just opened up, it's this: that the democratic rights that we have, we assume, but you don't get to keep them unless you are aware of what's going on and unless you're willing to take a stand. And that's really what the division of light and power is all about. It's like, you know, I took a stand. We saved our municipal electric system. It cost me politically, yes, but by concerted effort and an unwillingness to knuckle under these corporate interests, you know, long term, it was a victory. And the idea is that if we're going to preserve this any semblance of a democracy, we've got to stand for basic rights here. And we've got to make sure that if we're having commerce, that those rights are respected abroad as well. And that's, you know, that's been the conundrum in American politics. But I can tell you again, Bob, you know, this journey that I've taken, which actually, you know, when I left office, I started writing the book, transparency here. I began writing the book on Forest Avenue in Berkeley. With you and Narda being there, it was your house, but I tried to write it, but the emotional experience that, of course, I describe in the book was so raw, and it was so, you know, mind blowing that I couldn't finish it. I just couldn't do it, and it took years to be able to sort it out, to be able to look at things forensically, slow it all down, pick it apart. And 40 years later, boom, here we have the division of light and power. You know, I appreciate a chance to discuss this with you and your listeners. And I hope that you get a chance, people listening, you have a chance to read it, to pass the word of it. Because I think that this book will give people an opportunity to understand the dynamics that go on, not only in Cleveland. This is not just about Cleveland. This is about all American cities. And in some cases, it might be about cities in other places.
Not in some case. I'm going to take charge here now, because this is a book that I've been waiting for 40 years, ever since I told you to write it back then. But, you know, frankly, this is a book that there should be a Chinese version. There should be a book about a struggle in a Chinese city and ultimately against the national power and against the Communist Party, which claims to be for workers. And it should be a struggle in Iran, and it should be a struggle, you know, in the Scandinavian countries, which are forgetting their own roots of obligation to ordinary people. The fact of the matter is the game is rigged everywhere. Okay, it's rigged in different ways and so forth. What populism means is holding the powerful accountable to serve ordinary people, the regular folks, and not con them. And that's what you represented. I'm going to conclude on that. This is a powerful book that should be translated into all these different languages, because what they need in China right now is a Denis Kucinich rising up in some town and saying, no, we don't want to privatize everything, and we want to hold it accountable, and we want these young women who are living in the farm and assembling Apple phones to be paid decent wages and have a right to strike, and have a right to speak out, and so forth, and have decent working conditions. So the message of the division of light and power, and I want to stress this, it's you can order it now, but June 8th is when it officially comes out, which is a matter of, I don't know, what, 60 hours from now. You can get this book, at least in its Kindle or electronic form. And it is a joy to read. And, it just takes what, you know, this stuff is made deliberately boring and complex, you know, regulation of power and so forth. And the fact is that it's what the major thing that impacts people's lives. And what you are able to do is put life into this, whether it's the story of the mafia out to kill you in Cleveland or the banks out to destroy you politically in Cleveland. It's Mr. Smith goes to Washington, it really is a great American saga. So I want to end on that note. The book is called The Division of Light and Power. Check it out, and most of all, read it. Okay, and I want to thank Christopher Ho at KCRW, the great NPR station in Santa Monica, for getting these things posted. I want to thank Natasha Hakimi for writing the introductions, Lucy Berbio for doing the transcription, Joshua Scheer, who actually worked in your Washington office at one point, is the executive producer of, cool. of Intelligence. And I want to give a particular shout out to the JWK Foundation, which in the memory of Jean Stein, a woman I believe you encountered, a writer, a terrific writer, Jean Stein.
I knew Jean. She was wonderful.
Yeah. And she has actually, and the foundation in memory of her has given us some support to do these shows. So that's it for this edition of Sheer Intelligence. See you next week with another edition. Je ne regrette rien, c'est payé.